This is Roger Penske, and you're listening to Pit Pass Indy, sponsored by Penske Truck Rental.
IndyCar fans, it's time to start your engines. Welcome to Pit Pass Indy, a production of Evergreen Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce Martin, a journalist who regularly covers the NTT IndyCar Series. Our goal at Pit Pass Indy is to give racing fans an insider's view of the exciting world of the NTT IndyCar Series in a fast-paced podcast featuring interviews with the biggest names in the sport. I bring nearly 40 years of experience covering IndyCar and NASCAR, working for such media brands as NBCSports.com, SI.com, ESPN Sports Ticker, Sports Illustrated, Auto Week, and Speed Sport. So let's drop the green flag on this episode of Pit Pass Indy. Welcome to this week's edition of Pit Pass Indy, presented by Penske Truck Rental, as we continue our fourth season of giving IndyCar fans a behind-the-scenes look at the NTT IndyCar Series and the drivers and teams that compete in the Indianapolis 500. It's off to the Southern California desert for this weekend's The Thermal Club $1 Million Challenge. It's an event weekend that includes a crucial two-day open test, group qualifying sessions, two heat races, and a 12-car all-star race with $1.756 million at stake, the largest purse for an IndyCar Series race outside of the Indianapolis 500 presented by Gainbridge. The Thermal Club also is opening its gates to a few thousand guests as it hosts a public event for the first time. Spectators will include members of the Thermal Club. Tickets were originally priced at $2,000 per guest, but have since been reduced to $500 and includes full access to the paddock, pits, and lavish dining areas. The special event has a series of special rules, including pairing up drivers and teams with members of the Thermal Club. In a sense, it's an IndyCar fantasy camp for wealthy motorsports enthusiasts. At a draw party on Thursday, March 21st, Thermal Club members will be paired with the 27 full-time teams scheduled to test and compete Friday, March 22nd through Sunday, March 24th. Members will be embedded with their respective teams with immersive integration, including, but not limited to, team meetings, driver question and answer sessions, racecraft instruction and tips, and use of premium authentic race team gear. A previously announced sharing of total prize money between paired members and drivers who finish in the top five will not occur, but will not impact the purse total for drivers and teams. Announced earlier, the total driver and team portions of prize money for the Thermal Club's $1 million challenge include a total of $1.756 million. First place pays $500,000, second place pays $350,000, third place $250,000, fourth place $100,000, fifth place $50,000, and 6th through 27th place will collect $23,000 each. One of the drivers that will be battling for the prize money is two-time NTT IndyCar Series champion and 2018 Indianapolis 500 winner Will Power, Team Penske. He joins me for this exclusive interview for Pit Pass Indy. It's been a long time since we've had a chance to chat with our next guest. It's Team Penske's Will Power. Here we are in Will Power's trophy room, otherwise known as his basement, overlooking beautiful Lake Norman. Will, you got off to a pretty good start to the season in the Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg as Team Penske finished first, third, and fourth. You were fourth, right behind Scott McLaughlin. Of course, Joseph Newgarden was the winner of the race. That's a pretty good start to the season to be able to have all three drivers in the top four. So how can you parlay that into continuing the momentum, especially as we head into this weekend's special event at the Thermal Club? It's not a points race, but still it's a race you want to win.
We worked extremely hard in the off season. I would have to say, you know, performance wise last year was disappointing, apart from the Indy 500 for the team. But we're certainly looking forward to the next few races, especially Indianapolis. We've worked very hard. So we got thermal, good prize money. It's sort of a a test, 2-day test with some big prize money at the end. So it would be very nice to get that, of course. But you're really putting a lot of weight on the next race that matters, which is Long Beach.
Is the testing function of the Thermal Club more valuable than the actual All-Star Challenge?
Yeah, the testing is interesting. We needed to improve on road courses anyway, so we certainly have a lot of things to try. But on the other hand, when you add in that you can win, $500,000 to win the race, or if the team finished first, second, third, that's a lot of money. You're going to be focusing on what's good for that actual track. So I'm sure we'll break that up. There is actually quite a bit of time to test. You get 5 hours on the first day or 4 hours on the second day, I think. So yeah, it's a bit of both. You're definitely going to try get through all those things that you want to try for the tracks that really matter for the points in the championship.
They issued the rules and the format for the Thermal Club $1 Million Challenge last week. It basically is an elimination round with some heat races until you finally get into the final, which will be 12 drivers. Is the biggest reason why they're doing it that way is because the design and the shape of the track would make it pretty difficult for 27 cars out there at once?
No, I think you could do 27 cars. I think they're trying a different format just to see. It's not for points, so, it is the time to try that sort of thing. I mean, I suggested a no-reply push-to-pass to improve racing on that track to stop the sort of follow-the-leader type racing. But, yeah, I think we could have done a full race there. I actually think it would have been more interesting to have a full Grand Prix because there's massive degradation. But I'm not sure the pit lane could have handled that. That may be why.
So do you have a complete understanding yet of the format and how it works? Because it really does it's like you're going to be there late on Saturday and then the race starts first thing in the morning on Sunday.
Yeah, no, I know. It's a lot of testing. 2 10-minute qualifying sessions at the end of Saturday, and then you start heat races on Sunday. So, yeah, you get a lot of time and tires heading to just 10 minutes. To me, the 10 minutes at the end of Saturday determines everything. It really does. Like, I think if you qualify on pole or you start the final on pole, it's a very good chance you're going to win the race.
Do you think once fans have an idea the way the format works that they'll see that it can be pretty exciting?
I think the problem will be the lack of passing potentially. I think you would need something like no reply push to pass to really have a lot of action in the heats so you can actually make some hay. Yeah, we'll see. But a full Grand Prix is always better because you got so much time to play with strategies and different tire strategies and outsmart people. This format probably breeds a little bit of desperation. So, you got to weigh up, do I want to do any damage to the car and potentially hurt a wrist or a hand or an engine if you crashed hard, which would hurt the rest of your season. So it's kind of interesting.
Is it also going to make you widely aware of who you're racing with? There's some drivers out there that I'm sure in an act of desperation, you don't want to be around.
Yes, but those drivers that are generally desperate prey on, a championship contender from the beginning. They know this guy's always playing a bit of the long game. Well, they're not going to have that. So you may see a different personality come out of a driver that's usually, like Dixon, myself, I always try to play a long game, but guys like that may be way more aggressive because, hey, I've got nothing to lose either. And I might just pay this guy back because I'm sick of him.
Do you see paybacks happening this weekend?
Yeah, no, not from me. I shouldn't say that, but it wouldn't, why risk anything? Why risk anything for it? It's, you don't want to hurt yourself. You don't want to hurt the car. You don't want to hurt the engine.
The Thermal Club itself is a very interesting place. It's really multi-million dollar motorsports enthusiasts that live there. And one of the other interesting things about the format of the Million Dollar Challenge is there's going to be a draw between the members of the Thermal Club with the drivers that will be participating this weekend. One of those members will be embedded into your team, full crew uniform, headset, the whole thing. Do you see that as being a really good way, out of the box marketing opportunity and promotional opportunity that IndyCar can give in a situation like this? You're not going to do anything like this in the Indianapolis 500, but for an all-star race without championship implications, why not? Do you see this as a good thing to do some of these things?
I think it was a very good idea. You know, you're getting, like you said, it's a motorsport complex for extremely wealthy people. Motorsport needs extremely wealthy people to make it run. So you're getting partnered with potential sponsors and creating interest in the IndyCar series itself. So I thought it was a brilliant idea for, let's say, an open test turned into, what do you want to say, a million-dollar race on Sunday. Yeah, I like that. I thought it was a very smart idea, and let's see how this whole thing rolls and what we get out of it.
Do you think some of the members of the Thermal Club may realize when it comes to motorsports that there's a lot more that they didn't know that they thought they knew?
Yeah, but they'll get an inside view of how you know a race weekend runs, sort of, because it's not a full Grand Prix and not your typical race weekend, but yeah, they'll be partnered with a driver, I think. Is it a driver or a team? I think it's a driver.
Yes.
And they'll get to see firsthand how that driver operates. It's a top level of motorsport. It has become incredibly data-driven and competitive, so there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to learn for an amateur racer.
But when you're back there in these debriefs and the engineers are going over data and the drivers are talking and sharing information, to have somebody that you're really not familiar with in that environment, is that a little difficult for a driver to accept?
It's fine. It's what the program is. And for me these days, anything that helps IndyCar, I'm all for it. You know, it's like the 100 Days to Indy TV show. I think all teams, drivers, team owners, team presidents need to be very open to allowing them to come in, because it has done so much for Formula One, Drive to Survive, and and looks like it's going to be the same for NASCAR. So to me, you got to be very open to these ideas. You got to keep growing, keep finding ways to get the younger generation interested in your series.
There's been a lot of talk during the off season about some of the things that IndyCar wanted to do that aren't going to happen. You've been extremely active in the hybrid assist device testing, which was supposed to have been part of the season from the start of the season all the way on. Now it looks like it won't be implemented until the July race at Mid-Ohio. What are your thoughts on delaying it? And you have been there from the beginning of hybrid testing and where it is at now. How much ground has been gained?
A lot of ground has been gained. The last test I did was pretty flawless. There was, no toe-ins. The system worked very well and worked the way IndyCar wanted it to work. So I think the only issue that they may have is supplying enough parts. I think that actually was the issue. So, yeah, but the system itself is fine. The system will work fine. You know, obviously when you have 27 cars with that system on, you're going to have to, you know, vet a few issues. But, you know, it's very important for the manufacturers. That's really, you know, they put a lot of money into the sport. So it's got to be relevant. And they need that for their marketing, and they need it for information for what goes in a real road car. So, you know, it's the car, funnily enough, right now is in a really good spot. It's lighter, it's more nimble, and it's fun to drive, which I think down the road with the hybrid, that will become the case again. It's just the beginning of it.
Tino Belli, IndyCar's director of aerodynamic development, actually pointed out that for the first time in his career, the IndyCar in the street and road course setup is actually lighter than the Formula One car. And how important is that, that IndyCar has addressed the weight issue to this point?
Yeah, so he'd be talking about a Formula One car at full race weight, I'm guessing, because they have to fuel for the whole race. Yeah, so once we run through this hybrid, this particular system that we're running right now, I think, you know, in about 3 years, we'll come up with a much more efficient, lighter, better system, and maybe a new car with that. And then we'll be able to knock some serious weight out of the whole thing and build a very nice car. I think it's smart to wait and just take your time on doing that.
Graham Rahal believes you should wait till the beginning of next year for the hybrid assist. Some drivers don't like the idea that you start off the season with one set of rules and you end it with another.
I kind of agree with it. Like, I would like to just keep the same formula all year. I do. And I think that would be the case if it weren't for, you know, I think that, you know, Honda really wants to get this thing rolling, and I think it's in their marketing plan. So I think that would probably be the reason why that we have to do it this year. But yeah, I agree. I think having the same formula all year is a better situation. But I don't know all the details behind the scenes on what contracts are signed and what's in the contract. So, you know, clearly there's a reason they're doing it.
We'll be right back to Pit Pass Indy after this short break. In the world of racing, Penske means performance and winning. For good reason. Since 1966, Team Penske has won 44 national championships, 17 in IndyCar alone. And last year, Team Penske claimed its Indianapolis 500 record-extending 19th Indy 500 win with Joseph Newgarden, the latest driver to win the famed race. Team Penske also won its second straight NASCAR Cup Series championship. In 2022, Penske was the first team in history to win both the IndyCar and the NASCAR Cup Series championships in the same season. Team Penske enters the 2024 NTT IndyCar Series season with 236 IndyCar wins, including 34 500-mile race victories. Those are results that are tough to top. But Penske's legendary reputation for quality and attention to detail makes a statement off the track, too. When you need a truck, whether for your business or for a household move, Penske Truck Rental has some of the cleanest, newest, and best-maintained vehicles on the road. And we make it easy with personalized support from our associates, flexible reservations, and access to the top technology. With quick pickup and drop-off at more than 2,500 locations across North America, our scale and know-how will keep you covered, all helping to ensure you get the right, reliable, fuel-efficient vehicle when and where you need it. On the highways, the raceways, and every pit stop in between, Penske keeps you moving forward. Gain ground with Penske. Get a quote today at PenskeTruckRental.com or, for household rentals, download the Penske Truck Rental mobile app today.
This is Will Power of Team Penske, and you're listening to Pit Pass Indy, presented by Penske Truck Rental.
Here is the rest of my exclusive interview with two-time IndyCar Series champion and 2018 Indianapolis 500 winning driver, Will Power of Team Penske, for Pit Pass Indy. Speaking of Honda, you're a Chevrolet driver. You've been a Chevrolet driver most of your career. But speaking of Honda, when a Honda spokesperson made the comment back in December that unless IndyCar addresses certain cost controls and relevancy situations, that Honda may consider not renewing once their contract expires in 2026. You, as a competitor on the Chevy side, how did that news, how did that comment affect you in terms of, I mean, it was a pretty shocking comment.
It would be a real pity to lose Honda. I think we've been real lucky to have them as one of the manufacturers. They're a great competitor, very tough to beat. And, you know, I think that IndyCar needs to do it's what, you know, whatever is possible to keep them, obviously keeping in mind that, you know, you've got to satisfy multiple manufacturers. But, yeah, that would be a real pity. I hope that doesn't happen. I really do hope that they stay in IndyCar. And I think IndyCar is looking at coming up with a formula that is just that just makes it easier for any manufacturer to come in, where it's not this huge commitment of $50+ million of research and development to build an engine. I think I read that in an article that a spokesperson from Honda said that is sort of what they're pushing for. I think that's a pretty good idea. Very best idea I'd heard in a long time, because when I think about how much over the last 15 years, how much development has been done with this engine formula, it's impossible for anyone to come in and think that they could be competitive even within 5 years. So, yeah, the formula has to change for another manufacturer to come in.
I believe what you're referring to was had the internal combustion engine developed and built by one manufacturer or one engine company, such as Ilmor, and then let Honda and General Motors, Chevrolet, be in charge of all the electronics and the computer mapping and all of the software that goes into the engine. But when you do that and it's still the same power unit, would fans still see a difference between the two manufacturers? Would drivers still see a difference between the two?
I don't think fans really could tell the difference between the two manufacturers now. Like the power is so close, the formula is so tightly controlled. I don't think even in Formula One, where it's even more open, that if you painted all the cars the same, a fan could tell the difference. So it's that would not be a smart reason to do it, to not change the formula, is because you want people to see a difference. If you want that, well, you go to sports car where they really do sound quite different. But it saves a lot of money. If you do a formula where one manufacturer, one engine builder builds all the engines, and so Honda, Chevy, they don't have to spend millions on developing an engine and end up with the same horsepower as each other. All that money could go into marketing. And it makes it so easy for any manufacturer like Mercedes or Ferrari, whoever. Obviously, they would be fantastic to get manufacturers like that in, but they can badge an engine and then work with software on the hybrid side of things, the electric side of things. That's a smart idea. That is to me, a smart business idea. That is, you will get more money in the series. It will be easier for any manufacturer to come in and pay for marketing, pay for, you know, put money into a team rather than developing an engine. So I like the idea. Like, obviously there's a lot of things to go through to really nail down the rules of that, but just sort of that rough sketch of what that could be, I think is a great, great idea. And I think all motorsport is just heading that way. It's all heading in that direction.
And for a lot of Indianapolis 500 fans, all you got to do is read the history of the Indianapolis 500 and you will see there was a large portion of the race in the 60s, 70s, and 80s where Offenhauser engines, Meyer-Drake engines, were in every car in the race. It's only been in the last 30, 40 years where we've seen a lot of different engine competition between big-time manufacturers. Of course, it was that way in the beginning days of the Indianapolis 500, but there was a long period there in the 60s and 70s where the Offenhauser was pretty much the engine that everybody used in the race. You brought up a good point, though, about sports cars. Michael Andretti would like to see the same engine platform used in IMSA be available for IndyCar, because he says then manufacturers, which IMSA has 18 different engine manufacturers across all of their different categories, but he says then you could get two racing series for a little bit more than the cost of one.
Michael Andretti, just want to get this right, he wants the engine that is used in IMSA right now in IndyCar.
Yes.
Coffee. yeah, I actually don't know what that formula is and what the weight of that engine is and so on. But I mean, yeah, you could look at many different ways to make it cheaper. That might be one. I haven't actually looked into that. But that sort of idea that, you know, it seems as though everything's heading to is a good idea. However it's done, however that's done, you know, I think it's, you got to really think about it and speak to the manufacturers involved to see what is possible. But that, I think, should happen.
And then that way you can tap into all the different engine manufacturers who are already involved in motorsports and give them the opportunity to also compete in the Indianapolis 500 and IndyCar. So in a lot of ways, don't you see that as being a real viable option?
Yeah, you're saying because IMSA already has so many manufacturers invested in that actual system. The system is incredibly heavy. There's a problem there with the hybrid system. Incredibly heavy, and that is a problem for our cars. Then, you know, our cars are too small to fit all those batteries. But the actual engine itself, I'm not sure what that weighs. The actual engine, I don't even know what, are they a V6 or a V? I think they're a V6 turbo anyway, so they are a very close formula anyway.
Now, another issue that developed during the off season was on February the 14th. IndyCar and officials of the Big Machine Music City Grand Prix announced that because of construction issues with the Tennessee Titans Stadium that's built basically where the race course is for the Big Machine Music City Grand Prix, and also the lengthy permit process in the city of Nashville with a new mayor in charge, that they had to move off the streets of Nashville and take it to Nashville Super Speedway. I know there was a lot of excitement and buzz about having this big event on the streets of Nashville that would be going through Broadway and through all the entertainment areas, the entertainment district of Nashville. But to be able to make this decision to finish the season championship on an oval, what are your thoughts on that?
It's a real pity for the street race not to happen. Like, that's just no question. That was going to be amazing. But yeah, I don't mind the tracks that we're going to finish the season. They're definitely tracks I like. I have raced at Nashville, actually. It's been so long, I can't even remember it. But
concrete.
Yeah, I want to finish the season on ovals in a very strong way, because I didn't get to do that when that used to be the case. I lost some championships that way, so I'm looking forward to, with a ton more experience, being able to challenge for wins and so on at the end.
Well, you're going to get that chance, because the race weekend prior to that is going to be the return to the Milwaukee Mile in a doubleheader that Hy-Vee is going to sponsor, by the way. And the last couple of Milwaukee races, the Milwaukee Mile, you pretty much started in front and ran away from the field. So
in 14, I did, yes. 15, no. But Milwaukee's a good track, man. It's a good track for us. It really is. It's a lot of tire drag, multiple lanes. I think we'll race well there. So certainly looking forward to that one. And we'll have the hybrid at that point. So the car will be a real handful.
How will the style of racing change with the hybrid in terms of strategically knowing when to use it?
Yeah, that will be totally driven by, you know, the data. Where is the most efficient place to use this? Because you've only got this much power to use over a lap.
Because the schedule is the way it is, originally IndyCar would be having a race at Texas Motor Speedway in the early days of the season. But because NASCAR moved their date up to where IndyCar was, not going to Texas, which means the next championship points-paying race will be the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach, the third weekend of April. To have that big a spread between championship races, good thing, bad thing?
It's a bad thing. We need to have just too big of a break. I think it just happened to be that, unfortunately. We couldn't find something to fill it, but that won't be the case going forward, I'm sure. They're looking for something to fill that gap. I mean, we'll be busy testing. We have the open test at Indy. We have this thermal thing coming up this weekend, so we've got plenty to do But to be off television for that long is too much.
And also the fact that you will not have an oval other than the Indy 500 open test, which will be, I believe, April 10th and 11th. You won't have an oval race prior to the Indianapolis 500. I know a lot of times teams like to have an oval race just so that they can have their systems ready. The car is definitely set up differently for ovals and street and road course races. Pit stops, things of that nature. Does that make the Indy 500 open test that much more important since there won't be an oval race before the Indy 500?
Yeah, you get a lot of laps around Indy. I think having an oval race before Indy is not bad for drivers to get their head in the game of oval racing. It's much more dangerous. You take a lot less risky moves. It's not completely necessary because you get a bunch of drivers that turn up that haven't raced all year at all, and do that right and do the 500. So. Yeah, but you get a lot of laps. You get a lot of laps at Indy. You get laps in traffic. You get a lot more test laps than anywhere else all season.
Joseph Newgarden was one of the first drivers that understood the value of social media, even back when he was with Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing or later Ed Carpenter Racing. He always had a way of understanding and connecting through social media. This year, however, he's gotten off social media, says he wants to focus on racing, wants to bring the joy of racing back. Looked like he got off to a pretty good start on that by winning at St. Pete. How big of a 180 do you see that being from probably a driver who originally understood social media better than anybody to now understanding the downside of social media and how it can negatively impact the driver's focus?
He still does a lot of social media, but he doesn't do it. He's probably just not looking at it, which to me is a pretty good idea. It's not the best thing to spend your time, waste your time looking at.
Social media can take a great day and make it a bad day quickly.
It can. It's you can waste a lot of time just looking at junk. You know, it's necessary to have social media and make it available to people who want to see what you're doing and have, a following. But yeah, it's tough on the mind. Just it's sort of overload of too much information, too many different topics. Your brain is jumping from back and forth. I think it probably affects your focus.
This is going to be a tough question for me to ask, but you've always operated on your program as Will Power over here. For the last couple of years, it's been Joseph and Scott McLaughlin as the Bus Bros. The Bus Bros are no longer a thing. Do you see them looking at each other now as more rivals necessarily than bros?
Yes, I do. Yeah, something changed there. I think it changed when Scott started out qualifying Joseph and beat him in the championship last year. He probably thought, he can't be my Bus Bro anymore. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could see that coming from a mile away. I've been around too long to know that stuff just doesn't last. At the end of the day, you're in extremely, extremely tight competition and you're not wanting to give anything away to anyone. So, yeah, pretty tough to have a close relationship with anyone that you're fighting intensely with on track for championships, 500s, race wins and so on. So, yeah, that stuff never really lasts. You can always see when someone gets serious. I mean, look at Palou, look at Dixon. Look at all those guys. Look at Verstappen. You don't see them being buddies with anyone. And that's just the nature of this sport.
Do you see yourself becoming more buddies with Scott McLaughlin lately than necessarily you were when he was one of the Bus Bros with Joseph?
No, nothing really changed. I've been the same. Just focus on my stuff. Respect your competition and... Yeah, I understand. I understand the sport so well now and I understand, you're very perceptive once you get to being around as long as I have. So you know almost what these guys are thinking and, the things they say and do. You understand them pretty well. So, I like Joseph and Scott. I think they're very competitive. Good guys, like them, pushed me along really well. But yeah, no, nothing's changed with me with those guys. It's been pretty much the same.
Motor racing is probably as much an ego-driven sport as any professional sport out there, because if you don't think you're the best, then you don't deserve to have a ride. So when you get three drivers that have this ego-driven ability in them, how difficult is that to coexist sometimes?
It's a very interesting situation, teammates, because you're working the office together, but ultimately on track you're fiercely competitive and trying to beat each other. So very unique sport situation to me. I'm trying to think of another sport where that's the case, where you have to work with them in the office and try. You know, they see everything you do. They get your data. They hear your debriefs. They can put your setup on. So, yeah, it's in my younger days, it was very intense, very intense. You didn't really like it that much. Now, I enjoy it. I mean, I'm not saying I enjoy I'm not as intense towards my teammates. You know, I'm just not. I still have strong desire to beat them. You know, they're the ones you want to beat the most, because they've got the same equipment as you, but it doesn't grind on me as it did when you're young. I think because you're young, you know, it matters a lot. It really does, because you are trying to keep your ride, trying to be the, you know, especially now there's so many good teams. If it comes to negotiating a deal, like, it really matters. So it's more intense at the early stage of your career. It certainly is.
And wrapping up here with Will Power, the two-time NTT IndyCar Series champion and the 2018 Indianapolis 500 winning driver. Last year was obviously difficult at the beginning of the year because your wife Liz had a serious health issue and you needed to really play a role in her recovery from that. Amazingly and miraculously, she appears to have recovered quite well. But how much better prepared do you feel you are in 2024 to regain your focus and go after a potential third IndyCar Series championship?
Much, much better prepared, no question. Much fitter, and just in general, way, way, way more on top of it. Looking forward to the next few races. St. Pete was good, but just 21,000ths of a second, you know, just sort of got held up a little bit in qualifying on the money lap, and all those little details matter, but it'll come around for you if you keep knocking on that door. It will open.
Speaking of opening the door, he's going to be trying to open the door to the big race out at the Thermal Club this weekend, the $1 million Thermal Club Challenge. Team Penske's Will Power, good luck in that race. Good luck in the 2024 season. And thank you for doing this interview in this beautiful view of your trophy room that overlooks Lake Norman. And thank you for joining us today on Pit Pass Indy.
Yep. Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back to Pit Pass Indy after this short break.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Joseph Newgarden, winner of the 107th Indianapolis 500, and you're listening to Pit Pass Indy, presented by Penske Truck Rental.
Behind every great IndyCar driver is a team of engineers and mechanics that helps prepare a race-winning car. On Team Penske driver Joseph Newgarden's crew, Luke Mason of Australia is his engineer. It was a winning combination in the 107th Indianapolis 500 on May 28th, 2023, and it was also a big winner in the March 10th season-opening Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg in 2024. Let's get to know Luke Mason's story as he joins me in this exclusive Pit Pass Indy interview. Joining us now on Pit Pass Indy is Luke Mason, the engineer for Joseph Newgarden. Luke, I would have to say that by the way the Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg turned out, with Newgarden leading 92 of the 100 laps in the race, that had to be a pretty flawless day. Did the race go exactly as you had planned?
Well, we missed those 8 laps, didn't we? So we didn't quite go, it wasn't quite perfect, but you can't honestly start a year off much better than that. It was everything we could have asked for after last year, and our efforts on the road courses and street courses last year to bounce back like that was pretty cool.
Well, of course, the 8 laps is when people have to pit. You do have to make pit stops in those races, but in a lot of ways, it also proved the value on a street course of winning the pole, being able to determine the pace of the race and the agenda of the race, and it seemed like that is what Joseph Newgarden did for the entire race.
Yeah, correct. And the way that race kind of the strategy dictates is it's very, very tight windows, and obviously fuel save and wanting to do the race on 2 stops is the fastest way to the finish. So, you know, having that track position right at the start and having the lead really allows you to go as fast as what we needed him to go to make sure we could make the fuel and still have a bit in the bank, because in those style races, the only time you really have to make moves and the opportunity to pass people is in those pit exchanges. So making sure you've got enough fuel to be able to go hard for those 2 or 3 laps makes a massive difference. So a big part of it is just controlling our pace, making sure we've got speed to burn when we need to, and making sure that, you know, not allowing anyone else to do anything different and get around us in the pit exchange.
Was the only time he was challenged was at the very start of the race with Felix Rosenqvist? Because it seemed like that was about the only time. Once he cleared Rosenqvist on lap 1 and he just pretty much was in front the rest of the way except for the pit stop exchanges.
Yeah, and I think we saw that, you know, at the start of the race and at the restarts, that the alternate tyre was definitely the favourable tyre at the restarts early in the stints. It seemed to come on a little bit quicker there. So you had an opportunity very early in the stint that if you're on that faster, softer tyre to make some moves. So, you know, in our case at the start, you know, a big part of our planning was making sure that we could hold the lead at the start. And if we could hold the lead at the start, it really allowed us to dictate the rest of the race.
IndyCar has taken some weight out of the car. A lot of that is done because there's going to be more weight added to the car once the hybrid assist unit becomes part of the package. Right now, it looks like that may happen at the Honda 200 at Mid-Ohio in July. But with a lighter car, does that change your fuel calculations? Does it change your speed? How much does the lighter car change from what you have to do as an engineer?
You ask the drivers, it makes a big difference. You know, you think that 25, 30 pounds, you know, that's not a great deal. But, you know, you speak to these guys and how much more agile the car is on the track, and especially on low fuel and qualifying when they have a new tyre and the grip level is really high, how much harder they can actually push. So, you know, it does make a massive difference. In terms of saving fuel and everything else, you're more governed by, you know, what the tyre is and what the track conditions are and a few other variables there. So the weight doesn't really affect the fuel as much as say, what the tyre has done.
How involved have you been in the hybrid assist unit testing?
Done a fair bit. You know, we've been lucky enough to be able to, you know, do a lot of the testing for Chevy at Team Penske. And the way we've kind of done it here is we've cycled through all the race engineers and all our other performance engineers to try to get everyone involved and sort of see what the hybrid's all about.
And how much of a difference will it make as a tool when it comes to its implementation?
I think it's going to be a big deal. I think the driver now has a lot of tools at his disposal there to be able to use, and you know, the hybrid just adds another variable, you know, what you can do there to, you know, control what the car does as the tyres wear, and then in other aspects, what you can do to set up a pass. You know, it might be a case that come next year at St. Pete in a fuel style race like we had, that you know, someone might burn a few laps of their hybrid system and actually be able to make a pass and get around people.
The season starts with one set of rules minus the hybrid, but if all goes the way we think it will, or as IndyCar says it will, at mid-season, likely at mid-Ohio, the second half of the season will have the hybrid. Is this something that you as an engineer looks forward to, or would you rather see the whole thing delayed till the start of 2025?
I think if you ask any engineer in the paddock, they'll say they hate change. We don't like change. We like things to stay the same, and it allows us the time and the freedom to be able to optimize everything and get it to exactly how we want. But at the same time, you know, if we're thrown in the deep end like that, we'll be ready to go. And again, it's just another exciting chapter of the year that we have to deal with.
Well, I'm going to throw an analogy out there that you may or may not get, but it'd be like Major League Baseball saying the first half of the season of the All-Star break, we're going to use wooden bats. After that, we're going to use aluminum bats. In a way, do you see this as being similar?
Not quite to that extent. Like, you know, based on the testing we've done, the racing doesn't really change all that much. You know, the car doesn't change that much. It's just another tool that we have to maximize better than everyone else.
And what will the strategic advantages be of the hybrid?
I think it's more on just the racing side. Like the driver is going to have the ability to be able to manage his energy over a lap. So, you know, much like we see with push to pass, our drivers are using that strategically to defend or make overtakes. You're going to be able to do that with the hybrid system as well. So it's just another element for them to be able to use to either hold their position or make lap time or try get around someone in a race.
Now, that's looking pretty far down the road in terms of when the hybrid assist unit will come into play in IndyCar. Looking to this weekend, however, it's going to be a little bit of a different competition for IndyCar, a non-points-paying all-star type race, the $1 million challenge at the Thermal Club. And you as an engineer, the fact that it's going to be heat races, qualifying heat races, and then the actual main event, which will be 12 cars, how do you look at the concept? How do you view it as being what they're attempting to do in IndyCar?
Well, it's funny because the race length itself is the shortest one we do, but in terms of, you know, practice time, because there's a two-day test beforehand, so, you know, every car's actually got a lot of tires and a lot of practice time to get their car dialed. So I think you'll find that it'll be a lot of people, you know, because testing's so limited and the amount of work we have to get through during the day on our testing program, you're going to see a lot of people trying a lot of different things, getting their road course car package dialed, because for a lot of us, it'll be the first opportunity to try a lighter weight car at a road course on the road course tire. And then come qualifying, you're going to hope you've got everything right and you're going to throw everything at it you can, because at the end of the day, $1 million is $1 million.
Is the value of going to the Thermal Club more the two-day testing that you'll get to do for, because like you said, testing's limited. Will that be more valuable than the actual $1 million challenge itself?
I think in terms of what we're after and what's going to help us as the year goes and progresses on the road courses, I think the testing is valuable. You know, what we get to go through and learn there, you know, we can apply to all these other road courses we're going to eventually race at. But as I said, once we get there on Saturday and qualifying starts, we put our racing hat on and everyone wants to win. It's just another chapter we can add to our year. And, you know, I believe in momentum, and that's a real big thing in racing. And, you know, we want to carry that momentum that we started with at St. Pete and keep the ball rolling.
One of the unique aspects of the $1 million challenge is a member of the Thermal Club will be involved in a draw with all the drivers that are in IndyCar, and that member, depending on which driver he draws, will then become embedded on the team for the rest of the weekend. What's it like to have someone like that deeply embedded into what some of the things that you guys do behind closed doors?
Well, hopefully we can bring him behind the scenes and show him around and show him what we do, and they can host us for a few beers afterwards on the balcony of one of those houses, because there's some pretty nice places out there for sure. But, you know, having anyone come behind the scenes, I think it's pretty cool for our sport to be able to show people what happens. And, you know, we're pretty closed off generally what happens in those engineering offices and what we talk about. But, you know, it's going to be a pretty unique opportunity for someone to get a real look behind on the decisions we make and what we do there.
Is that one of the unique things that IndyCar can do that other traditional sports can't do? You don't see NBA teams letting people into the locker room at halftime. You don't see NFL teams, you know, letting fans come in during the coaches' meetings. Is this one of the things that the way IndyCar is designed really gives them an advantage when it comes to engagement?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you only have to look at some of these documentaries that have come out in the last few years. You know, what we did last year with 100 Days to Indy, giving people an opportunity to, you know, peel back the curtain and see what we actually do behind closed doors every weekend. You know, to us, it's just going to work and doing what we do is just a normal day-to-day deal. But, you know, for a lot of other people watching, we're pretty lucky and we have a dream job. You know, we go to racetracks and work on race cars. So I think the more people we can expose to what we do behind closed doors is only a good thing.
Speaking of lucky and having a dream job, working with Joseph Newgarden, he's won 30 IndyCar races, 13th on the all-time list, broke him out of a tie with a legend, Rick Mears. They were tied with 29 victories each. But to have a driver like Joseph Newgarden is the driver that Luke Mason gets to work for as an engineer, what's that like?
Well, you ask him, he's got 30 and we got 38 to go to get AJ, so the pressure's on. But at the end of the day, it could be a lot worse. You know, I think, you know, knowing that you've got someone like him driving the race car, you know, what he tells you, you trust is... trust is going on. You know, he's got the pedigree and he's got the runs on the board to be able to tell you that if something's right or wrong with the car, you know, what needs changing in the direction we need to go in. So for me, it makes my job super easy at some of these places. You know, he says it's the car needs to do this and I can work on fixing that. And other times he'll say, don't touch it, I made a mistake and I'll get you that 2/10. You know, having someone like that where you're not chasing your tail all weekend just makes a world of difference.
How would you describe Joseph Newgarden, because a lot of fans see the personality side of Joseph Newgarden, the engagement, the way that he talks to fans, the way that he's been on social media. He's got a great sense of humor. But for those of us who see him at the racetrack, he's a pretty intense guy. Would you say that there's really, it's kind of like two different personalities with him?
Yeah, but I think you have to be that competitive and that driven once you get to the racetrack. You know, I think a lot of people... You do see a different side of him when the helmet goes on and the eyes are on and it's go time. And I don't think that's any different to a lot of professional athletes in the world. You know, you see once they step on the field, you know, the intensity level increases and people change and the competitive juices start flowing. So I don't think he's any different in that regard. But at the same time, I said hopefully, you know, what 100 Days to Indy showed last year is there is a different side. And, you know, we saw that on that program. We've seen it with the Bus Bros on YouTube, and you know he can have a laugh, and he's actually a good guy behind the scenes. So you know, hopefully more people see that side of him as well, and understand that you know he's here to do a job and win races. So when he needs to switch on, that's what he needs to do.
So we know how difficult it is sometimes to get three ego-driven drivers together to operate as a team. Team Penske's been able to do that. What's it like in the engineering room? Because I'm sure that you want to out-engineer a car more than the other engineers that you work with for the other two drivers.
You would think that, but we're so cohesive here. It's like, you know, I think someone said it before that you could drop any one of these crew guys, be it mechanics, engineers, switch us all around and it doesn't matter. You know, we're all pulling in the same direction in here. And you know, you say ego-driven industry, but I don't think that really exists here at all. You know, we're very open in the engineering office between all three cars, and it's not just the drivers willing to help each other out, but the engineers helping each other out as well. And, you know, that's why I think you see the results on the board. You know, that's how this place has worked for a long time, and I don't see that changing in the future.
How often is it that you come across a setup or a change that the other two engineers say, hey, I'm going to try that?
I think it happens across three cars all the time, and given that the fact that, you know, our practice time has shortened in the last couple of years. You know, we used to have three sessions, and now we're down to two, and it's a bit of a divide and conquer on how we attack those sessions. So the three different cars might try three different setups in three different directions, and you know, one car might be higher on the board than the other two, and everyone will pull a different methodology from which car was fastest or what changes worked and what didn't, and put them all together for P2. So generally that's how we tend to work here and try get the best of all three cars into one package that hopefully come qualifying is towards the front.
We'll be right back to Pit Pass Indy after this short break. Welcome back to this week's Pit Pass Indy. Here's the rest of my exclusive interview with Team Penske engineer Luke Mason. So the Luke Mason story, where did it begin and how did you get here?
I'm a long way from home. It's, you know, everyone laughs about Australia and the outback, but I grew up probably in the most outback remote part of Australia on the West Coast, and always loved racing, always wanted to be a race driver, and unfortunately mum and dad didn't have the money to do that, so I did what everyone else would do in that situation and went to a racetrack and begged, borrowed and stealed until I got a job and started off as a Formula Ford mechanic and open wheelers, and then eventually ended up in V8 supercar and was lucky there for a 4-year period, and I reached a point where I was like, well, it's I can stay here for the rest of my life or I can, you know, have a go overseas, whether that be Europe or in America. And I got lucky that I knew some people over here in the States. So that led to a period in NASCAR, which was a very eye-opening experience, you know, never having turned left before. And said growing up with the metric system and trying to learn what the imperial system was a bit of a change as well. But we got through that, and that kind of led me to IndyCar. And I was a few years at Carlin there, which were really good in learning what the sport was all about. And then I was lucky enough to end up here at Team Penske, and the rest is history.
For those of us in the United States that truly don't understand geography, just how big a continent or how big a country Australia is, you know, a lot of us may look at it and think, ah, it's about the size of Texas, which no, it's a lot bigger than that. How long would it take to get from the western side of Australia over to the eastern side?
Yeah, it's funny. You look at it on a map and you think the place is pretty small, but the reality is it's about the same distance as traveling from, say, New York to LA in terms of flight time. So you're looking at sort of 5.5 hours to go from one side to the other if you actually wanted to do that. So it's pretty vast, and unlike the US, pretty much the whole middle of the continent is just desert and inhabited. So it may look big, but where everyone actually hangs out and lives is very small.
I was more curious how long it would take to drive.
Yeah, not interested in doing that. You know, I'm very grateful for our truck drivers we had when I was doing V8 Supercar. I would do the long haul trips there because you'd say goodbye to them, and then 5 or 6 days later, we would rock up after having flown for 5 hours, and those poor guys and girls had driven the truck all the way across the country. It's certainly a long way.
So to Luke Mason, how big a name was Will Power?
Very big. You know, to look at his career and what he's achieved as an Australian, and it's very cool. You know, arrive here and actually meet the guy after having watched him on TV for so many years was actually a pretty cool experience for me personally. And now to say that, you know, I've worked with him and especially get to know him a bit more and engineer him at some of these hybrid tests to really understand how he works. It's a very, very talented individual. And the way he goes about his racing is, some might say, a bit different, but at the same time, it's worked for such a long period, and you can only admire the results he's achieved over here.
How about Scott McLaughlin? Because he was already a legend in supercars.
It's funny, me and Scotty actually go a long way back. The last open wheel car he drove before an Indy car was a Formula Ford in 2011, and I was his mechanic on that car back in Perth. So it's pretty funny how we've ended up on the other side of the world at Team Penske working on Indy cars, or in his respect, driving Indy cars. So a lot of respect for what he's done, and the fact that he went from sort of tin tops in supercars and managed to transition to IndyCar, which, you know, is so much harder than I think everyone gives him credit for. And for him to be doing well over here, it just shows the talent that guy has.
So you've worked in Perth. Luckily, in Mooresville, there's a Perth Road. Did you find that to be rather ironic?
I did drive past it and have a laugh, and I was like, oh, I should try find a house out there, because there's some quite nice houses on Perth Road just down the road there.
But as far as the Indianapolis 500, it's world-famous race. A lot of people who are motorsports enthusiasts consider it to be the greatest race on earth. What was your view of the Indianapolis 500 when you were in Australia?
You speak to most people down there and they'll tell you the Bathurst 1000 is the biggest race, and that's the one that, you know, most young kids grow up watching, and I was no different down there. I would wake up early in the morning and watch Bathurst, but at the same time I can remember, you know, sitting in my room in front of a small TV at 2 in the morning watching the Indy 500, maybe 10, 15 years ago and understanding how cool that race is. And then to come over here, and I actually traveled across here in 2011. It was my first race as a spectator there, and you actually get to see the cars go past you. And I just remember being on the fence in turn one as this thing approached at 240 mile an hour and went, you know, bloody hell, that's the most awesome thing I've ever seen at a racetrack. And I tell everyone the same thing, is I don't think you've experienced the pinnacle of motorsport until you've sat in turn one or turn three and seen an IndyCar go past you that quick. It certainly changes your perspective. And from that point onwards, just to understand the history of the sport and what's come before us, and, you know, to be lucky enough to be here at Team Penske to add to that history and to win Roger his 19th is just the cherry on top.
From an engineer's standpoint, though, the way that Joseph won last year's race, it took a lot to get there. But once he got there, you could just tell what it meant to everybody.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, we started at the open test and, you know, rolled out a race car there and a package that, you know, I remember talking to TC after that test, and it was, we were amazed how good our race car actually was in that package. And, you know, Joseph's comments echoed that about, you know, just give me this car in May and we're going to go win the race. So, you know, it took a while, and it's been no secret that, you know, in the last few years that we've battled some qualifying speed issues, and it's something that we continue to work on. And, you know, hopefully come May this year, we make our job a little easier starting towards the front instead of starting towards the back. But, you know, we're always confident that we had a race car that if we gave him the opportunity to go win the race up the front, that he was going to be able to deliver for us.
From a psychological standpoint, how important was it for the team to win the first race of the season after the way last year's championship ended?
It's everything. And I'm a big believer in momentum in sports. And, you know, to come out and do that after what was a bit of a struggle for us on road and street courses. And yeah, you can say we had a great year and won four races on the ovals and, you know, everything's fine, but the reality is that we dropped the ball a bit on the road and street courses last year, and we needed to be better, you know, not just ourselves, but as a group at Team Penske. And, you know, to come out the gate like that and have three real competitive cars running at the front, I think shows the amount of work and effort that's gone in the off-season to everyone here.
It also seems that Chevrolet has found a bit of an advantage with the engine. What is it exactly that they were able to discover? I know you can't go into details, but what is it about the effort Chevrolet has done to come out with a better package?
Yeah, and I think that all the Chevy drivers echoed it over the weekend is the work and effort they put in on the off season. You know, we gave them such a long menu list of items that we wanted and thought needed to be better to be more competitive. And, you know, generally, you rock up at the first race, you only get one or two of those ticked off, and it's like, okay, this is what we've got. We've made progress here, and, you know, let's put ourselves in a position to go have a good year. But, you know, what they were able to deliver, I don't think they missed anything at all. Like, they nailed every single one of the points that we had. And I said, it's not just one area, it's every area. Everything about this package is just better. And it really makes our job so much easier when you've got such a strong engine package, and to show that out of the gate, I think they deserve a lot of credit for the win.
Going back to this weekend's race at the Thermal Club, the Million Dollar Challenge, it's not a points-paying race. Will Power said, because it's basically a winner's race. You're there to win the race, as most people are every weekend, but you're not thinking about points. You're thinking about checkers or wreckers. Do you see guys might be a little bolder, more aggressive in this type of race on Sunday?
I wouldn't be surprised. I said it's a lot of money on the line, and at the same time, everyone wants to win regardless. I don't think there's any different that you're going to see someone racing for the win at St. Pete's, say. I think if the door's open, someone's going to throw it down there and try win. So, you know, I think that mentality applies to most people everywhere we go, but certainly not being a points-paying race. I think you might see a few people a bit more desperate than others trying to get that $1 million.
Now, the fact this race doesn't pay points, going back to the regular season, though, they always say every race pays points, but it seems like the way the schedule is going to be set up at the end of this year, with so many ovals at the back half of the season, including the last race of the year at Nashville Super Speedway, do you really feel that really sets up very well for Joseph Newgarden to get his third IndyCar Series championship?
You know, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't excited when I found out they'd moved the race from what could have been a chaotic street course in the downtown streets to an oval, which would help us. But, you know, at the same time, we can't rest on history and what we achieved last year. You know, it's everyone gets better every year and we have to do the same thing. So, you know, all we can do is put ourselves in a position that once we get to that stretch that we're in the hunt and you know, provided we execute and show up with good race cars like we did last year and leave it up to Joseph to do the rest, I think we're going to be in a pretty good position to try win his third.
Now, the Big Machine Music City Grand Prix may not be racing on Broadway in 2024, but you can certainly celebrate a championship on Broadway in 2024. So obviously that's the party is still going to be on Broadway.
Yeah, and you'll see me right in the middle of it if we get it done because I love that city and you know, the excitement that that place brings to, I can only imagine what the party is going to be like if we won the championship for the hometown boy there.
Luke Mason, race engineer for Joseph Newgarden at Team Penske. Good luck at the Thermal Club this weekend. Good luck in your quest for Joseph's third IndyCar Series championship in 2024. And thank you for joining us today on Pit Pass Indy.
Cheers, Bruce.
And that puts a checkered flag on this edition of Pit Pass Indy. We want to thank our guests, Team Penske driver Will Power and Luke Mason, Joseph Newgarden's engineer at Team Penske, for joining us on today's podcast. Along with loyal listeners like you, our guests helped make Pit Pass Indy, presented by Penske Truck Rental, your path to victory lane in IndyCar. On the highways, the raceways, and every pit stop in between, Penske Truck Rental keeps you moving forward. Gain ground with Penske. For more IndyCar coverage, follow me at Twitter at Bruce Martin, one word, uppercase B, uppercase M, underscore 500. This has been a production of Evergreen Podcast. A special thanks to our production team. Executive producers are Bridget Coyne and Gerardo Orlando. Recordings and edits were done by me, Bruce Martin, and final mixing was done by Dave Douglas. Learn more at evergreenpodcast.com. Until next time, be sure to keep it out of the wall.